All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? How are you? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. You know, it's sad. Sad day. As I tell you this, I learned that Bill Paxton, the actor, passed away because of complications during a surgery. And the guy was just here. He was just here. He was sitting across from me in the empty chair that I'm looking at right now, just a few weeks ago. It was episode 783. It was just a couple weeks ago. He was right there, full of life. I was so excited to talk to that guy. I didn't know him, but I sometimes get very excited to talk to people in here because I love him. I love his work. I love all his work. Seemed like an intense, great guy, and he was. He's a very gracious, giving, lit up human being over there, just sitting there, excited to be here. I was excited to talk to him, and now he's gone. Life is so fucking fragile. You just don't know what's going to happen, and it's tragic. But I tell you, I'm glad I had that time with him. Like so many of the people in here, like all I'm looking for is to connect with a human being. And that guy was just full on force of nature, human being, grounded, decent, excited, passionate, talented guy that we all know from all the movies. It's just fucking awful. It's just so sad. But that life is just so horribly surprising sometimes. And I'm in shock. And I barely knew the guy. I had one conversation with him. I shared it with you guys, and it was amazing. I was hoping to see him again, see more of his work, but he's gone. Passed away. And it's funny because he when he was in here, you know, he said, no matter how many movies I make, Weird Science is going to be the first thing in my obituary. He said that sitting right there in that empty chair across from me. There's a lot of empty chairs everywhere, folks. It's part of being human. But it is funny, though. Because, you know, there's really nothing wrong with being known for playing a funny role that made an impression on so many young people, you know, as a movie that they never forgot because of Bill Paxton. But the first line in pretty much all the obituaries I saw was how Bill Paxton was a versatile and generous actor, and almost everyone who has paid tribute to him that I looked at talks about what a kind and friendly person he was. God. Damn it, just 2 weeks ago. Life is so fucking fragile and surprising and incomprehensible at sometimes. Many of us have been feeling this, you know, for weeks now. Maybe for years for different reasons. And then the sadness deepens when things get close. And he was right there in that chair. It's been a few people have sat there that are no longer with us. And when I really think about it, it's brutal. It's a brutal fucking reality of life. But man, am I glad I got a chance to talk to these people. It was just great to get to know him as a person. We always got to remember that there are people in front of us. That if you go outside or you spend time at work or wherever you go, see those people. See them. Get out of your head. See the people. It's very important now to see people, to engage empathy, to connect, as human beings who want to live good lives, free lives, and do what they want with their life in comfort, safety. You know, I don't know. I'm lost in a certain swirl of sadness at the fragility of life, and that's understandable. And my condolences and heart go out to Bill's friends and family, and it's just horrible. I guess out of the gate here, I should tell you that, my guest today, Raoul Peck, is the director of the film I Am Not Your Negro. It is a powerful documentary about James Baldwin, and I had to watch it two times because it is so deep, so moving, and so powerful, both in words and actions, and the scope of what the conversation is in the film and the one I'm about to have about the film. It's an amazing movie. I was excited that Raoul Peck could be here. And I was just looking at quotes from Mr. Baldwin online here, and one of them is, "I love America more than any other country in this world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually." It's important. It's important to keep that in your head. But other things, I guess I should tell you about this. June 1st, if you're in New York City or the surrounding areas, you might want to think about going to this year's Book Expo, because I will be there to conduct a conversation in front of a live audience with my old Air America co-worker, Senator Al Franken. You can go to BookExpoAmerica.com to get tickets. If you're not seeing the full Book Expo across both days, you can get a single day pass. Just remember, my event with Senator Franken will be on Thursday, June 1st. It will be fun. I really am excited. I get a kick out of Al. The senator, he has a new book coming out called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. So we'll have a lot to talk about, not only about, you know, his SNL days, but also about being a United States senator. And one with a great deal of spunk these days, thank God. And incidentally, I guess I should tell you that I also have a book coming out later this year. Well, I should say we have a book. It doesn't come out until October, but I can tell you a little bit about it now. It's called Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By from the WTF Podcast. And I'll tell you this, people, when my producer and I started on this more than 2 years ago, we did not know what it would be like. I don't think we could have ever imagined what an amazing thing it is when, you know, like, it is really, without question, the best possible book to come out of doing this show. It's an amazing thing to hold in your hands and experience. I know that sounds like hype, but we're both really proud of this thing. And I think it's a special thing because, like, to be honest with you, once I have these conversations in here, you know, that's it for me. And reading this thing through and seeing how things that are said in connection with another human being, with someone there to bear witness and hold the space and feel what you're saying, and to read it is like, it's unlike reading anything else. And I could not believe how fulfilling it was. And again, it's not hype. We're just very proud. I'll tell you more about it when we start the pre-sale, but get excited. It's going to be something you'll definitely love. Comes out in October. It's a long ways away, and God willing, we'll all be here and still able to buy books. Am I being dark? My guest today, Raoul Peck, made the film I Am Not Your Negro. It is a documentary about James Baldwin. Now, I felt a little insecure, I guess, or not, maybe not insecure, but a little ignorant, maybe is a better word, in that just about 6 months ago or so, I saw footage of James Baldwin debating William Buckley at Oxford in England. I had not read James Baldwin's work, and I have not read much of it, very little. And after watching that piece of that debate, I was blown away at the level of humanity and intellect and the depth of it all that that man had. And I was very fucking moved. I had to watch it two or three times. And then when I got a screener of this film and watched it, I had to watch it twice. The depth of his intelligence and, again, his humanity is just profound and not unlike anything else. Cultural criticism, film criticism, political criticism. But the movie is really moving through this book that he never finished, that he wanted to write about his three friends, seeing, you know, his life and the struggle of America and race through the deaths of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Medgar Evers. And it had a lot of footage of Baldwin, like on the Dick Cavett show, on talk show, some footage of that debate that I saw. It had bits and pieces of films, and it was all from his words, sort of assessing the racial predicament. And I felt a little out of my league to talk to Mr. Peck about this, but I just copped to that. And because the movie had such a profound effect on me. And it was so disturbing, really, how little has changed on some level in a very deep way. And, you know, what really kind of struck me, and you'll listen to the interview, is just that it's, again, about seeing other people with some form of compassion. If you are not blinded by anger one way or the other, and you are not, you know, reacting to something that your head is generating, you know, it's very hard now. You theoretically, you're supposed to have some control over what you let into your mind, what you let into your head. And a lot of times we prefer things that substantiate our points of view, that make us feel better, that that seem right. And a lot of times it's not, on all sides. But it's become very hard to filter. And because of that, I think that a lot of what you are reacting to, most people in general, or hating or loving or whatever, is in your head. It is not in reality. It may have some point of reference in reality, but it is not. It is in your head. And you got to separate that, man. Because I think what we're losing is our ability to see each other as people. And we just can't fucking afford to lose that in any way. And I talk about that a bit with Mr. Peck and about, you know, a lot of other things. But I'll tell you, that movie is powerful, and it needs to be seen a couple of times. So I actually watched a bit of the Oscars last night to see if my guest's film was going to take Best Documentary, but that went to the O.J. movie, which was also a great film. But I Am Not Your Negro, it stands alone as something. It's really an amazing document of an amazing person, amazing mind, and a profoundly deep understanding and bringing together of a lot of ideas that are frankly horrifying, but real. And it provides a lot of insight into exactly the human dynamics of those forces. So it was a great pleasure to talk to my guest, the director of I Am Not Your Negro, Raoul Peck. So join us now. How's it going? This is exciting. You're running around. You're an Oscar nominee.
Like, I can't even, you know, where I am and where I'm going, where I'll be in 1 hour.
Is it exciting? Is it?
Well, yes. You know, as a filmmaker, you know, especially when you spend 10 years of your life making a film, a complicated film that you don't even know if artistically it can work.
Yeah.
You know, to and So having survived that, and then you have such a great acclaim that, you know, you see how the film is changing people, you know, the discussion after the movie, you know, not only during Q&A, but after Q&A, people stay in the room or in the lobby or in the parking lot, and they have discussion. And then they come back. They come back with their family, their friends, they organize groups to go to see the film together, just to be in that ambience again, in that atmosphere. It's incredible.
Well, so. I it's like for me, you know, I watched it and then I watched it again because the depth of James Baldwin as a thinker is beyond anything I've ever seen before. And, you know, I get nervous because, you know, there is, you know, as a white guy, you know, watching this movie and then having the opportunity to talk to you, there's part of me that thinks like, I'm not qualified.
Well, that's the contrary, because Baldwin talks to everybody.
Right.
It's not about who you are. It's who you are as a human being.
Right.
And he confronts you with that.
Exactly.
Know, your responsibility is as a human being, not as a white person, as a black person.
Right.
We each have our duty or responsibility. And he's telling all of us, you better face it. You need to respond to whatever is happening in this country.
And I get that, you know, but the interesting thing for me is a guy who's a, you know, liberal guy, who's a guy who, you know, is thoughtful. I've read a few books, that there was a feeling of like, you know, somehow I'm complicit.
Yes, of course.
You know, it was something that did wake something up. You know, you take a lot of things for granted.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, the way I see it is like you have this great teacher of yours, you know, who knew you since you were 10. Mm-hmm. And then one day he sat you down and said, listen, I'm going to talk to you. And I'm going to tell you, you know, this is life and this is what you've been going through. And there are some stuff that you need to face.
Yeah,
and the way he said it, in a very, it's not antagonistic. It's not with hate or with anger. Or the anger is the anger of somebody who have gone through so much and wants to let it out. But he's not aggressing you. He's, you know, and that's very rare.
You know? And also,
and so you listen to that voice,
of course, and you listen to it, and you know, he speaks, because the footage you have of him, you know, there's Dick Cavett footage. With, you know, in a conversation, and then there's some other talk show footage, and then you have Samuel Jackson doing an amazing James Baldwin.
Incredible, yes.
Samuel Jackson has such a distinct voice that I didn't realize it was him both times.
Well, that's the same. People have now a sort of cliche, I would say a Tarantino-esque image of Samuel Jackson, and he's much more than that. He's an incredible actor. He was a stage actor.
Yeah.
So he's somebody who learned his skills.
Sure.
Who's incredibly talented and can do anything.
Yeah.
And the way, you know, I didn't have to give him too much direction. It was just the only thing I could tell him, you know, you need to be the voice.
Yeah.
You know, I do not want any distance between you and these words. You know, we are inside James Baldwin's head.
Right.
So you need to feel the emotion. You need to feel the tragic. You need to feel the irony. You need to feel the
and
joy.
And he did.
And exactly. So it's a performance.
Yeah. And now is all the narration taken from the, you know, the manuscript of, it's called that, Remember This House?
Yes. Well, it's more complicated than that.
The letter to the editor.
Yeah, exactly. There are a few documents that were handed to me by Gloria Carifas-Smart, who's James Baldwin's sister, and who's running the estate.
Yeah.
And 4 years into the process, where I was still struggling about what is the right organic approach to make this film,
because
I had access to everything, published, unpublished,
to the estate,
from the estate.
Yeah.
They gave me, really, that's unprecedented.
Yeah.
Never happened before in the film industry.
Well, let me ask you a question from that point there, that, you know, your credentials are deep. You know, you've been involved with film for decades. You have a production company, which I read about. But, you know, where do you come from? Because, you know, clearly, you know, it's not an American accent or whatever.
I have a complicated but a complex life. I'm Haitian. I'm born in Haiti. My parents left to go work in the Congo.
Did they flee?
They flee. My father was arrested twice. And
by Papa Doc?
By the regime.
Yeah.
He lost his job. He was a professor at the Faculty of Agronomy.
Why was he arrested?
Well, you didn't have to do much in a dictatorship to be arrested.
Yeah.
You know, he was not really politically implicated. It's just, you know, because you didn't campaign for the dictator, and so you are taken as an enemy. By the way, we are seeing that today in the U.S. administration.
Yeah.
If you don't agree, you have to leave.
Yeah.
So imagine what it is in a country that, you know, going through dictatorship. Yeah. So he just... you know, knew that he had to leave.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the UN came to Haiti and had 400 contracts for Haitian doctors, engineers, and professors to go work in the Congo, because Congo was newly independent, and the Belgian, who had, you know, kept everything under their hands, never trained Congolese to be able to rule their country.
Right.
So they had to do that like in an urgency measure. So they came to Haiti because Haiti is, you know, one of the few black countries who had an elite, who had, you know, people fully trained and who spoke French as well. And so they recruit a lot of my father's generation.
And you made a feature film about...
And I made a film about Lumumba, who was the first prime minister of Congo, assassinated by the CIA, the French, and some other... the Belgian. So Congo was a very important place for me. It was my first link to the continent. And I went to school there. After a few years, we had to be evacuated to New York because there was some political problems. And so I went to school in Brooklyn, in a public school in Brooklyn, near Flatbush Avenue and Nostrand Avenue. And so that was my first, you know, really experience in the United States, in this country. So that's when we applied for residency, because we didn't know, you know, we knew we couldn't go back to Haiti. That's the only thing. Because don't forget, the dictatorship lasted until 1986, you know, until I was an adult after my studies. So
do you remember, because like there's certainly part of this film, I'm Not Your Negro, is there is a sense of terror underneath it in some, you know, in very real way, that there is a sense of violence and terror and horrendous separation of people. Do you remember that from your childhood?
Well, there was several type of terror. There was the terror of roadblocks in Haiti. You know, I remember the first time my father was arrested, and we just knew because he didn't come home. And my mother took me in the car. I was the only child at the time. I have now two more brothers. But at the time, I was the youngest, the first child. And I remember being in the back of that car. It was night and roadblocks. And my mother going everywhere. And there was a, you know, curfew. You know, she was not supposed to be on the street. It was 9 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
And it was a very strange, you know, confrontation with terror, because, you know, at those roadblocks, they could just decide, you know, to shoot or to arrest you or, you know, to do whatever they want. There was no rules.
Yeah.
And incredibly enough, when we went to Congo, we had the same kind of roadblocks as well in time of really big political confrontations.
Yeah.
And when I went to Brooklyn, it was a time where, you know, you could get mugged in the streets.
Yeah.
So I felt like I grew up always in knowing what violence was and what, arbitrary was. And I think that had a profound influence on me and my work. You know, if you know the list of my films, in every film there is this notion of, you know, people owning your life and in a very arbitrary way, and deciding about your, you know, being killed or not. And this is a sense that I always kept with me, you know, even in Germany, where I studied later on. I think there was not one single day I didn't think about the Holocaust. You know, that, you know, Germany being an incredible country, you know, who produced the best brand of the of this century, you know, from, you know, Einstein to to the best, you know, composer of, you know, Wagner and all the others, great thinker. And that same country was able to produce that kind of monstrosity that the Nazi regime was, you know, and it's those elements always kept me alive throughout my life. And that's where I rejoined Baldwin at some way. You know, he has a quote, and I'm very bad at quote, but he said, you know, every human being is an incredible miracle. And I learned to love the miracle they are, but also to protect myself from the monster they have become.
It's hard to tell sometimes.
And yes, and but that's something. It's what he says is about, you know, how you deal with people and societies, and you know, we can do the most incredible of things and at the same time become the worst monster possible, and all this in good conscience. You know, when your question before about, you know, the moral monster, you know, when Baldwin calls the whole Western civilization a sort of moral monster because they went into countries, colonized them, or they invented slavery somehow. They use it with totally good conscience.
Right. And he goes on to talk about how if only the people that were enjoying this, you know, quote unquote freedom,
yes,
knew how many lives it cost to sustain it and create it.
So that's the Western civilization, and it's also the reaction of, let's say, the winner. The winner decide about the narrative.
Right.
So, right. And we have been in a very Eurocentric world for several centuries now.
Right.
So, and in being that, we forgot, or they forgot, that there are other realities. And, you know, when you get to write the narrative, you decide who is the good guy and who is the bad guy.
Right. And then there was that point where, in the way you structured the film, when it towards the beginning, where they thought that vengeance was theirs to take because they had the moral high ground.
Exactly.
Which was, you know, at times genocidal.
Yes, yes, yes.
So when you were in Germany, is that where you went to film school?
Yes, I went to Berlin. In fact, I went, you know, I never had in mind to become a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. You know, coming from Haiti, this is not something serious you do as a living.
Sure.
My parents, you know, of course, you're going to be an engineer. And so I choose something that was in between. You know, there was a new diploma called, you know, industrial engineering. So it was part engineering and part economy. So the mixture of the both, that's something that seems appealing to me. And yeah, I knew I could work in all kind of industries. So that's what I went to study in Germany, in Berlin. And I did those studies. It's a very long, because it's a double study. You know, I spent 7 years studying. I finished. I got my diploma and my master. And I started a PhD for development policies. And 2 years into that PhD, my thesis father died in a car accident. And parallelly, I was already working with friends on, you know, I was making photos for different German magazines and newspapers. Uh-huh. I would do interview. Berlin is an incredible cultural city.
Yeah.
You know, you have the biggest film festival, biggest jazz festival, theater festival. So I would usually try to have interviews or photo of, you know, artists coming from Latin America, from Africa, from the whole third world. And so that's how I met a lot of those people, great artists over the years. And so that was a kind of job I had, but it was my way to be in cultural circle all the time.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, I went to back to New York because my girlfriend at the time was a filmmaker and she had a contract in New York. So I went with her. I work as a taxi driver in New York. And but of course, journalists made it, you know, he was a taxi driver and became a filmmaker.
Right. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
No, that's not, I don't have that mythology.
It's right.
Just, I just needed a job that I could leave, you know, anytime I wanted.
Right.
And while I was thinking about my next step, you know. So basically during that time, I decided really to say, well, I really want to make film. And in order to make it on a solid basis, I need to go back to film school. So I passed the exam to the Berlin Academy, which was a very selective school. They took only 18 students a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very complicated, exam over, you know, several weeks.
What is it? What part? What does it do? Like, what are the
Well, you had, first of all, you had to bring, you know, a lot of pile of works that you have done.
Like photographs? Or
photograph. They give you, well, there is usually a thematic,
uh-huh.
and you need to do like a photo shoot about that thematic. You need to write a scene using that thematic. You need to do a sort of report.
Wow.
You know, a sort of documentary report.
They mean so business.
There are many layers. In fact, it's more to see what are your capabilities on different level.
Right.
You know, it's not like there is a particular profile to be a filmmaker.
Right.
They just want to see, you know, how do you fare among all these different, things.
They want to get a sense of your creativity
exactly,
and your capability.
Exactly. How do you transform a content into images or into a story?
Right.
So it's very competitive and it's great. It was a great exam. And it forces you also to discover who you are, you know, mm-hmm. because you can't really cheat. You need to be yourself
right.
and put something
on the page. You can't bullshit down.
Yeah. Yeah. You need to put your belly on the page, you know, and be naked, mm-hmm. basically. And so, and then once you get in, you know, it's one of the best schools because you don't pay anything, you know, it's state funded.
Uh-huh.
You have money to make your film and it's the training is you learn by making films.
Sure. So, and how long is that program?
It's a 4-year program.
So you really got in.
Oh yeah,
really
it was
dug in.
Yeah, in fact within 2 years I had already written a screenplay and which I submit to German television. And
what was that about?
It was my first story about a young Haitian poet who is living in Brooklyn, New York, and who was arrested in Haiti and tortured. And he met one of those torturers, a former military, in the streets of Brooklyn.
Wow.
And then he started looking for him to get revenge. So, but it was more an occasion for me to talk about this immigration, Haitian immigration, who had left Haiti because of the dictatorship. And because it was a long dictatorship, at one point, some of the people who were themselves murderers or torturers
got out
as well. And then they would confront in the streets of New York.
That happened.
Those are real stories.
Yeah.
I know people who were, you know, confronted to somebody who had put them in prison.
There was a couple of mass immigrations, like very dramatic on boats and
Well, that came later. That was, you know, another step up in the dramatic development of Haiti. But that's something, you know, I have friends from Chile or from Brazil or from Nicaragua who had gone through those same experiences.
Coming to the United States.
And then meet one of their former torturer.
That's incredible.
And it's a weird situation. Because
I would say so.
Sometimes you are here and you want to forget about your past. You don't want to be confronted with it. And then you see that this particular guy never had to come in front of a justice, trial. And then, the traumatic
Sure. And he probably fled because his wife was in danger.
Of course. You know, that's what that kind of regime do. You know, they use you, and then when they don't need you anymore,
you're thrown out. Or in jail.
Or killed.
Oh, so like right from the get-go, you know, because of your life and because of your experience, which is, you know, unique to situations like that, these films were, they were getting into it. I mean, you weren't, you know, making entertainment.
No, that's one of the things. I came to movie because of politics and because of my engagement. You know, it was, you know, I told you I went to film school. I think I was 26 already. So I was already an adult.
Right.
So I knew why. You know, it was not just, I want to make, you know, to tell story, work with actors, etc. It was about, you know, how can I be of some use to my society or wherever I was living? And it was always about going back home.
Right.
You know, I study in Berlin, but knowing that at some point I will have to go back to Haiti and fight, you know, undercover or with, you know, some organization that exists.
Without a doubt.
Oh, yes. The generation before me, by the way, went back to Haiti and they were all killed. Because what we didn't know at the time is that the CIA knew about that. And they gave the information to the regime. Because the Duvalier was supported by every American administration, because it was a sort of bulwark against communists.
Uh-huh.
So they would prefer to have a dictator that is on the side than to have anything that sounds socialist or communist. So it was a very hard time. So I never thought that I was going to stay in Germany or in Europe. It was always about going back home. Don't forget, I was in film school in 83, and the dictatorship lasted until 1986. So my goal was to go back, and like the goal of many of my friends, it was always to go back home, whether you were Haitian or Chilean or from Nicaragua or from Turkey
or
from Iran.
However you can.
Yeah, it was about, you know, going back and serve.
And that's interesting that, you know, James Baldwin, you know, struggled with that decision. It was not innate to him to, you know, once he fled America for personal and political reasons and spent all that time in France and really became who he was, that it seemed in the film, there was a reluctance that eventually became no choice.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, you know, and you never can totally renounce to where you come from, to where you grew up, or to where, you know, the first smell you had, the first ice cream you had. Yeah. All those are important memories in your life. So when you are forced to leave your country, and that's to come to the refugee crisis here, or crisis they call, you know, nobody wants to leave his hometown. You know, even, you know, here we are a country of immigrants, you know, but why is it we have Little Italy, we have Chinatown? Yeah. It's because you still have that cultural link and that somehow emotional link to wherever you come from.
Forever, yeah.
Yeah, forever. And so when Syrian refugees are coming, it's not because some of those people, they were happy in their country.
Yeah.
You know, even when they didn't have much money, but it was their country. It was their place of birth. And so to suspect them, or the Mexican, you know, it's whatever is going on right now is really unacceptable. You know, we are witnessing, you know, fascistic attitude toward other human beings, you know, women, men, children. You know, it's like you put a stamp on them as they are criminals. And even the language you use, you know, I remember hearing those language before a genocide in Rwanda or the Nazi genocide, you know, because that's the first thing, the first step you take when you want to kill an enemy. You start giving him names, and then those names transform themselves into insect name. And once they are at that stage, you know, from bad hombres, the next step is to say they are, you know, rats.
Right.
And then you can kill rats.
Yeah.
You know, this type of words using, you know, the rhetoric of that, this is a rhetoric of genocide. You know, those signs. I don't think we would get to that point here in this country, because first of all, there is resistance.
Yeah,
there are institutions, but still, the mindset can do a lot of damage.
Well, it's terrifying, and that in the film, there's a moment where, you know, Baldwin is talking about, you know, what people, you know, are reacting to with that hate is something in their own mind.
Yes. Yes.
It's not the real, it's not the person. It's not the reality. It's the need to have that hate.
It's a construction in their own mind.
Yeah. Yes.
Because, you know, I can, like he said in the film, you know, I grew up, I never realized that, you know, what does it mean, black?
Yeah.
You know, you don't wake up and look at you and say, I'm black. You know, you're just a human being. You know, you go to school, you have friends. You know, I had friends of multiple color, multiple nationality. But, you know, it's not the criteria I use to have friends or not. It's, you know, I'm your friend because we hit it together and we have something in common. But it cannot be our the color of our skins.
Right. And so when you start working on I'm Not Your Negro, this is a decade of work, because it seems like some of the thoughts that you're talking about, you know, just what was the moment where you're like, this is the man whose words in life that I can run these, you know, feelings I have through?
Well, I was very lucky to have read Baldwin when I was 17 or 18. So very early age. And when you can see a problem from the distance, you always have a better position, you know, because you're not totally in the, you know, anger of that moment or that place.
Right.
The same thing Baldwin had, you know, going to Paris for him was, you know, he understood his country better from the perspective of being in Paris. And in Paris, he understood that suddenly people were looking at him first as an American and then as a black person.
Yeah.
Because in Paris, you had, you know, black American, but you had black African, you have black Caribbean people. And for a French person, they are not equal. They are not the same.
Yeah.
So when you come as an American, suddenly, you know, you are somebody else. They see you as an American, like they see Hemingway as an American.
Right.
You know, the question, you know, is not, you know, you are black. I mean, so it's more, you know, complex than that. So being elsewhere give you, it's like you are on the top of a mountain. You can look down and have a bigger picture of whatever is going, and you can see the complexity.
Yeah.
And it gives you some structure.
And you were able to see that from living all these places simultaneously.
Exactly. So when I read Baldwin the first time, it just blew my mind, because suddenly what I had felt intuitively in my 17, 18-year-old brain was suddenly very structural, very analytic, and very poetic from Baldwin. He was explaining to me what I felt intuitively, but could not really express.
What was the first thing you read?
The Fire Next Time.
Uh-huh.
That was, you know, that book was important. And really, because Baldwin did one thing, is that he just said, this is who I am. I take a stand. And then the problem is you. You need to find your place. I know who I am. I know where I belong. So, and I don't let you define who I am.
Yeah.
And this particular society, because it's a letter to his nephew, you know, and he's explaining to his nephew who he is, the nephew, and in what world he is, and what he will have to confront all his life. But he's telling him, yes, it's going to be hard, but don't forget, you are a human being, and don't let people define who you are. And you're going to live through things that you can't imagine, that are not, you know, doesn't make sense. But you need to keep your sanity and understand that it's a particular society that is like that. And you have a particular history. And you need to know at every moment who you are and face that society.
Right. In the film, he says the history is not the past, it's the present.
Exactly.
Because you were brought here by it.
Exactly. And you need to confront it every day. We are the product of our history. And he also said that all of us, we share that same history. There is no black history and white history. This is the history of America. And we need to face our respective role in that history. And we need to take responsibility for our roles, our respective roles. That's the only way, the only form that we can take to solve all our problems and to construct a future for both of us.
So when you say it takes 10 years, because I notice that the structure of the film, it's thoughtful and it's very deliberate. You're constantly going up against, you know, mediated images or fictional images through film, television, of the black person and the white person in this country, because film and television, you know, dictate somehow and kind of structure our misrepresentation of reality.
Well, because film and images are ideological, grounded.
Yeah.
They're not innocent.
Right.
You know, anything you watch on TV or on the theater screen is full of very particularly thoughts or image of a society or prejudice. Or, it defines who you are. It defines who women are, what is the interaction between men and women? How do you treat children? How do you treat rape, etc.? Or do you treat violence?
Yeah.
So a film or transporting all of that. But most of us don't know how to read those different layers.
Right.
We take it for granted.
Right. And then James Baldwin read it.
And of course. And yeah. James Baldwin not only read it, but he deconstruct that.
Yeah.
What film is.
Yeah.
That's he's giving us a really lesson of the construction of what images are. In the particular when, as a black person, that you don't see your images on the screen. You know, you don't see yourself as a real person on the screen. Now it have changed a little bit. You can see, real yeah. great black characters in TV and movies and television series who have been very good at that recently. But still, the whole ideology package that goes through film, and don't forget, American cinema is the dominant cinema throughout the world. So I grew up even in Haiti, from 4 to 8, watching American film. You know, my African or Congolese friends, they also saw the same John Wayne Western.
Sure.
Or Tarzan.
Yeah.
And we knew as young boys that this is not totally reality because, listen, white guy killing, all the Indians somehow, this is somehow irreal. By the way, we could be the engines in that story.
Yeah, you knew that early on.
And then I remember very vividly, the first time you started to see black characters in Hollywood movies, and you could basically time at how many minutes the black character would get killed.
Right, yeah.
It's like the first 10, 15 minutes, the guy, he's going to get killed.
Right.
And then it took longer, as time passed, you had black character who survived the whole movie and could even be in the happy ending,
That's changed.
Yes.
So the movie is the half-finished or not even half-finished book, Remember This House, is about... him about James
Well, those were notes, by the way. It's not even a finished manuscript. It's really notes, 30 pages of notes that somehow tried to summarize what
he wanted to do
was going to be.
And so he's now, this is in the late 70s, so he's written many, many books. And you feel that this is something that's been, at the core of his soul. What do you feel that he was looking to...
Well, it was a very complicated and painful process for him. He knew, to go back, writing that book means I would have to go back to the South and meet Merrily Evers and meet the widow of Malcolm X and meet the children who are no longer children, etc.
Yeah.
That's for me, that gave me the story.
Yeah.
This is the story. What it meant for that man to go back that journey. And so it gave me the opportunity to go back to that journey myself and to find everything he have written about it. You know, the film was...
You draw from a lot of sources?
Yes, yes, of course. The film is full of different sources. One of the major sources was a book called The Devil Finds Work, which is a collection of James Baldwin essays on film.
Yeah.
He is one of the major film critics of this country. Because not only he could review films and books, by the way, but also he did it in a way where he delivers you also the instrument of analysis. He didn't just make, you know, like usual critics made, like sure. a very realistic critic, but he gives you the historic perspective.
Right.
He gives you the ideological perspective and the political one. What does it mean? You know, when he write a critics about The Defiant Ones, you know, the film with Tony Curtis and yeah. Sidney Poitier, you know, being chained, he uses it to explain what he calls, you know, the source of the white man hate and the source of the black man hate. And he compared those two hates.
Right.
So he goes into a very, you know, society analysis.
Real criticism.
You know, using the yeah. film. And so this is profound. And so that's why those essays are so strong. They are much more than just film essays.
Right, they're a complete intellectual investigation.
Exactly.
Throughout the film, your film, yeah. that, you know, you start with very current footage, I imagine, from Ferguson, to almost present that, you know, problems exist. This yeah. is not the past. And then, you know, you go into the heroes section. You know, after a little, you know, establishing, and you know, and that goes right into film, you know, into the idea that, and also into the three men you're about to
talk
about,
and how he was introduced to film, to yeah. images, and to the absence of his own images on that screen, or the absence of the images of his father,
right.
on the screen,
right, but then that evolves to that point where the only one that he could maybe accept as a real black character was the custodian in that film. I don't know what the film was and he really talks poetically about the fear in his face and that predicament. Yes. Somehow that was like, well, that has yeah. depth.
Well, that's exactly that, I think, what a lot of minorities, blacks, and also women, you know, we had to find our real self in films, sometimes in just a small piece of the film.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the case of Baldwin, that was this face.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way you would experience your own narrative in those films. It's like almost like stealing an image or stealing a scene from a whole movie and try to make that piece yours.
Right. But the profound thing about that moment, and especially at that time after, you know, he's moved through, you know, these black and white silent films, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and then the sort of the dancing Joan Crawford as being some okay. indicator that, you know, people seem to have fun and he had not put black or white onto it. But that moment in that film that connected with him was a moment of fear, just terror.
Yeah.
Of that man.
Yeah.
And he was like, that seems
because
like
it's the terror he have seen.
Yeah.
He have seen people, you know, for a young boy to, you know, that's something that many young kids in the South have seen, is the incredibly painful moment where your father or your uncle, who have authority upon you and who is raising you, and suddenly in the face of violence from outside, has to behave like a little boy himself. And when you witness that, it's very hard to, you know, to feel that your father, to be proud of your own father.
Or to feel taken care of.
Feel taken care of. And it's this terror is really traumatic.
Yeah.
And that kind of situation happen in many ways, and it's, by the way, it's not only a black thing. It sure. happened in a working you know, white worker situation where sure. you know, suddenly your father, who is a janitor or whatever, has to bow in front of his boss.
Yeah.
And when you witness that as a little boy, it's traumatic.
Yeah.
Because it changes your view of your own parents.
Yeah.
And so Baldwin was always very good at feeling those moments, of seeing them and describing them.
And also he was able to expand it, you know, intellectually and I think, you know, succinctly to an entire group of people.
Yes.
That, you know, that how they fit into the society. That you are unable, there's another theme throughout the film that, you know, how do you become a man if you are treated like that?
Yes, yes. And in fear.
Yeah.
That you, you know, how can you concentrate to become a man when, you know, every step can be a danger, can, you know, cost you your life, you know? And we are still living that in the present. You know, when, imagine when the parents have to, you know, you give your car for the first time to your teenage, you know, boy or girl.
Yeah.
And the first thing you have to tell, in case you are stopped by the police, don't do anything stupid. Don't move. Obey the order. And you're basically giving him a recipe for terror.
Yeah.
You know, you're not educating your children. You're telling him this is a dangerous world. So be careful all the time.
Yeah.
Never let go.
Yeah.
And this is a terrible situation. And people forget that millions and millions of people go through that every day in this particular country.
Yeah. And the second heading was witness, and that was, I found that that was very interesting right at the beginning. This is when he goes back to the States and he's going down south. He's becoming involved in the civil rights movement. And there's that thing he said about the line between a witness and a perpetrator or
an actor.
And an actor is very blurry.
Yes.
But it is there.
But what he meant also by that is, you know, there was a discussion at the time about, you know, it's either you are an artist or you are an activist. You know, and you had to choose, you know, and there were critics in particular in the literary world who would say, you know, once you start to write about a current issue, you're not a writer anymore. You are a journalist or you are, somebody who do news, but not art.
Yeah.
And Baldwin was torn between those two positions. And I think he found an extraordinary form to escape from that. And when you read his book today, they are very precise, they are very analytic, but at the same time, they are written in a language that is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Baldwin invented a way to write about America. And the written, the music, the word, you know, between preacher and ethnologist and, you know, and the way he used his humanism to describe a human being, etc. Yeah. This is exceptional. People tend to take it for granted. At the time, he invented a genre, basically. Yeah. You know, people like Toni Morrison or Endeavor, Toni said, you know, he gave me a language that I thought that was so beautiful. I thought it was my own.
Yeah, and he speaks it too, that, you know, when he put, just the time that he puts into putting a thought together, and seeing it all the way through in this very poetic and powerful way is I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, and I, in fact, doing all these interviews since the film opened, I realized that, you know, I started by saying, well, you should read Baldwin. And then I thought, no, in fact, you should study Baldwin.
Yeah. Well, you have to.
In the sense of, you know, Bible study.
Yeah.
Like you take a paragraph in the Bible and you speak about it and you have a whole philosophical discussion. That's the way we need to deal with Baldwin because it's so rich. Every sentence, you know, I remember the books I, you know, starting working on the project, I went back in my library and found my old Baldwin books that I have everywhere I live. And then I realized that almost everything was underlined, you know, from the first page.
At different points in your life.
Yes. That's how much that happened, you know.
Yeah.
You read any other book, you know, there is one place where you have a few notices.
Right.
You know, but Baldwin, you can underline the whole book.
Yeah, and sometimes it happens over years.
Oh yes, of course.
Different colors.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I that's why I went back to it, because I recently, in the last 6 months, I have not read a lot of Baldwin, but somebody sent me the clip of that debate at Oxford, and I'd never seen it before. And, I've read things that I have to go back and reread over and over again. And I watched that. I watched him sort of spontaneously generate these incredibly expansive and well thought out argument around race. And I was like, what is that mind? And I had to watch it, three times. Yes, exactly.
Because you can't follow, really. It's like, oh my God, I need to understand that really, or listen to it
right.
again.
And happening on so many levels.
Yeah, and you don't have time to recover.
Right,
No. It's like he's hitting you again and again and again.
And he did that all the time, even on those Cavett interviews, even when he was just saying something that was relatively succinct.
Yes.
The depth of it and how it's going to hit you as it integrates into your own mind and soul is like, whoa, it's daunting. And I think that what you did a great job in the film doing was that, the way you laid things out and the examples you used from film, TV, interviews, really elucidated the points he was making and engaged you visually in examples of what was trying to be said.
Yeah.
And sadly, there is no good conclusion.
Well, the conclusion somehow is, what he said at one point, this is the reality. I lay out the whole reality in front of you. There is no other way around. Now the question of the future is your response. What do you do with that? He confront us with that. This is it. These are the elements.
Yeah.
What do you do? Are you ready to take responsibility for that? That one single history. We are part of this same history. There are not two different history.
Yeah.
And we have done several things. We were actors in it. So and that's why for me the movie is about now,
Yeah.
It's the same situation. What do we do? We cannot pretend to be innocent. We are not in a innocent time anymore. We know all we need to know. Whoever or we are, black or white or Chinese, Native American, women, we know our history. If we don't, that's the other line, we are moral monster. Because we cannot pretend 2017 that we still don't know how the world is run, that we don't know our history, that we don't know that this country was built on two genocide, and that we need to deal with it. It's not about punishment, it's not about reparation, it's about knowing. Because knowing is already the beginning of change.
Knowing in moral terms.
And in moral terms, and also in reality.
Yeah.
Knowing the facts.
Right.
Knowing the numbers. When you say, let's make America great again, what does it mean? In that sentence alone, there are at least 20 mistakes. 20 mistakes. And of course, you don't have the time to rebuke every single piece of that phrase, which doesn't make sense, which is idiotic and a manifest of ignorance. And not only that of ignorance, but he takes you for an ignorant. And that's terrible. 2017, to be able to say a phrase like that is to erase the history of America and the influence of America throughout the world, in bad and good times. What does it mean? It means nothing. So it's important to come back to reality, not reality shows,
right?
But to come back to reality, and I think Baldwin, that's the strength of Baldwin, is to make us face that reality, and he speak to each one of us. That's what I've seen those last 2 months with going on the road with the film, is that the audience, whether you're black or white, you are confronted with yourself.
I think Baldwin, that's true. Yeah,
talks to you directly.
Yeah,
in a very friendly but direct way. He doesn't antagonize you. He doesn't accuse you of anything. It tells you this is the element.
Yeah,
pick your side.
Yeah, where are you on the spectrum of ignorance?
Exactly. Also, yeah.
What have you said to yourself that comforts you into thinking that you're doing enough?
Exactly. Yes.
Because that's you've got hate and you've got a way to compartmentalize that and decide it's not you. And then you've got this whole other thing, which is I'm not that way. All right. So that what's the next step? I love all people, but that was the daunting thing for me is that is anybody doing enough in these moments and what it's taken, who the hell knows what's going to happen here?
Yeah.
But, a lot of people certainly woke the fuck up.
Yeah. Well, that's the reality. It's like somehow we went in a sort of intellectual lethargy. And I call it once in an interview, it's like the gentrification of the minds.
Mm.
It's like we got lazy. Even after the civil rights movement where, we built monument for Martin Luther King and not for Malcolm X, by the way.
Yeah.
But, and then like everything is solved. And when we take the numbers, that's the thing. When you come back to reality, you take any numbers, the amount of people in prison, the amount of, young black or Latino kids who grow up without the parents, and why, the drugs numbers, et cetera. Why are, drugs that black or poor people take is hit more, gravely than, the white or middle-class white drugs or not. All those things, take any type of numbers and statistic, the reality will hit you hard.
And also there's discussion of class that never happens here.
Exactly. That's the big elephant in the room.
Because you have this, you certainly have drug epidemics now that are somewhat systemically hitting all types of people. And, the elephant in the room.
Yeah. Well, the inequality in this country.
Right.
We are now in a time of extreme concentration of wealth in the hand of a minority.
Yeah.
And we just hand in power to that minority. And we just accept that. And we have an incredible concentration of poverty in this country, the richest country on earth. And, I always wondered, how do people react if you put those numbers in front of them? Don't you take any consequence out of that? That those are the numbers that Oxfam published a few weeks ago, saying that 8 individuals, not 8% of the population, 8 persons own more or as much as 40% of the poor population, of the population of this country. 8 individuals. You're talking trillions.
Yeah.
How does that happen? And this has consequences to everybody, to the way the press work, the concentration of the press, that a few billionaires own all the press, meaning all the information we get, and journalists are not that free, they are less free than they were 40 years ago. And it's a whole chain of consequence, and of brainwash as well. And people, when you push consumption to people, you push, and on all level, consumption of reality shows, consumption of electronics in your life, consumption of everything. You can just make a phone call and get it to your house. You can order pizza, you can order. So it creates a generation of people on couch. Even your friendship, electronically.
And Baldwin sort of, he said that about TV is a narcotic.
Yeah.
Has a narcotic effect.
Exactly. He said the entertainment industry remind him of the use of narcotic. And he wrote that 50 years ago, at a time where there were only three national networks. Yeah. So imagine what it meant today. That means you could see those effect and impact 50 years ago.
He could,
yes. and you imagine where we are today.
Well, that's the fascinating thing, too, is that a lot of this stuff he said that long ago. and it is exactly the same, and also more sophisticated in some ways in a lot of analysis of it currently.
Yeah.
He saw the truth of it.
Yeah. And one aspect, because it's a matter of education as well, and but also even when you went to college, it's hard for you sometimes to see through what happening. You know, the example now. I saw the time when television and radio station became very partisan, and where now even network like CNN would have, you know, the guy from the left, the guy from the right, the right, and then the journalist in the middle, he's not, you know, he's not taking any side anymore. There is as if there is no truth.
Right.
You know, both positions have the same quality.
Yeah.
So that's what leads us today to have one side, a scientist who worked 40 years of his life on climate change. And on the other side, you have some guys who just decided that climate change don't exist. And those two positions are considered equal.
Right.
That's where we are today. You know,
yeah.
And that's just incredible, you know.
Right. And what gets lost there is the truth and the urgency of what is really happening.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we don't know that. Now people are putting in doubt everything.
Yeah.
You know, nobody has credibility. In fact, the loudest you are, the most credible you are, apparently.
And I think that's like in terms of the film. When it comes around to what we're talking about now and this sort of, you know, rabbit hole of hopelessness and panic you can get into around it, which I experience daily, is that Baldwin brings it back to human.
Yes, and he shows you that you can do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. But I see people say the film gives them energy because they just realize, well, I can understand that and I can do something about it. It's just about me deciding to give a response to that, because on the bigger picture, it's simple, it's clear. You know, there is no confusion. You know, we are not idiot, we are not ignorant. You know, there is a way to understand what's going on now. You know, you just step back a little bit and watch the bigger picture, and that's what Baldwin gave us. He gave us a 50 years picture, and where we say, oh my God, this is what. In fact, that's where we are. And then you can react, because it doesn't seem like this huge mountain of ignorance in front of you. You know, how do you start a discussion when you have to, again, I don't want to quote our current president, you know, make America great again.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to go into that to have to explain it. You just reject it. You don't lose your time to go into that kind of discussion. So that's what Baldwin gives you, you know, step back. You know, and then you can see what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And don't lose your time on the stuff that you're being bombarded with and that make no sense, you know.
Yeah.
And that's big part of our day, you know. The amount of tweet, Facebook, of reality shows, you know. Why would I indulge in the crazy daily life of a group of men or women buying stuff, buying merchandise? You know, my life cannot be that, you know, as a human being. It's not about, you know, how many cars I have or how many new clothes I have or, you know, how many, you know, new house I rebuilt, all that.
Yeah.
It's like just material to fool your brain. And take space. It just take place.
I know.
There was a scandal in France a few years back where the head of the French biggest private TV, TF1, in an interview, he just said, you know, my job is to bring films and shows on my channel so that you don't need to thank anymore, but you just need to buy Coca-Cola. You know, he said that plainly.
He's being honest.
And he's being honest. You know, he was not even cynical.
Yeah.
You know, and that, it's working. You know, it's working.
Sure. And it's, you know, it's even deeper than that. It's like, and now it's about not just buying Coca-Cola, it's about, you know, buying an ideology that you can use as reality. Again, it's what Baldwin said, that it's giving you what you need to hate in your head.
Exactly.
Without having going outside. Like the other thing that I started here was he said, people who say they care don't. They care about their safety and their profits.
Exactly.
That's big.
That's right there, a Marxist analysis of our society.
Yeah.
You know, which is a society built on profit. And that means profit invade every place in your life, in your action. And that's one line that the young Marx wrote, you know, like in the capitalist society, even human relationship becomes a relationship of merchandise. You know, and when you look at your own relationship sometimes, where you take decisions because of merchandise, because of money, or because of interest, this is what we have become.
So we've lost our emotional, moral, and psychological compass.
Yeah, yeah. And more, because we just don't have the space anymore in
it's
our
being
brain.
It's taken up.
Yeah. How many times we can have the proper time to sit and read a book?
Or to spend time with other people, to do what me and you just did.
Exactly. Well, yes, that was a real, you know, this is something I miss, you know, in the media, you know, to really be sitting with a real person and have a conversation without having to cut your thoughts.
Right.
Because we are complex. Yeah. We are today living in a very complex society. So there is no straight answer. You know, I like when they ask you, okay, tell me your life in a nutshell.
Yeah.
You know, no, my life cannot be reduced in a nutshell.
Well, that's interesting because as complex as it is and as that is driven by, you know, guiding people either for profit or for, you know, brainwashing or for, you know, competing illusions, is that, you know, people, I think this is one of the byproducts is that they get overwhelmed. And they need it simplified.
Exactly.
And it's not simple.
It's not. It's never. Life is not simple.
Right. But people together, talking together, you know, like that. See, that's my biggest fear now is that the polarization is so profound that, you know, how do we do it as people?
Yeah.
What do we do now?
But that's why Baldwin, you know, give us the chance to set back a little bit, take a little bit of distance, see it historically. Don't see, you know, what happened the last election. See what have been happening the last 50 years. And then you will understand where you are now.
Yeah.
You know, if you explain Donald Trump by just explain the campaign, you will not understand anything. But if you understand that Donald Trump came way back from Reagan.
Sure.
That when they start deregulating, when they start breaking the unions, etc., etc., this is what brought us here. And there have been other Donald Trump throughout the world. Yeah. So it's not a new model. You know, there was a guy named Berlusconi in Italy.
Yeah.
That is the perfect, copy of Donald Trump. Billionaires, authoritarian, a lot of ignorance, hater. Divider, and they finally got rid of him, you know. And it took times. He did a lot of damage, but Italy have, you know, came back to a better place today. So we shouldn't be afraid of anything, you know. We are this country. So the most difficult part is to sit down with the other one and have, you know, a conversation. And decide that we can change a lot of things together. And that, of course, that's not a simple process. There are no recipe. There are no shortcut. And this is something that we lost. And when Baldwin gives you the whole list of what it took to organize the civil rights movement, you know, it was about learning. It was about sitting together and have meetings. It was about raising money. It was about finding allies. You know, everybody was in the movement, not just black. You had the unions, you had the churches, you have the Jewish organizations, you have the youth of organizations. And this was a huge coalition. And it took time, it took patience, not only anger. And that's something that today we voice our anger. But then what do we do?
And also now, like, because of these disembodied voices of persistent psychic terror, you know, through platforms that are disengaged from human beings in a way and are redundant in their hate. There was a moment in the film where he talks about the exhaustion that, you know, you have to figure out a way to continue fighting so you don't get exhausted.
Exactly. Because they get you tired.
Yeah.
And so the question is always, how do I put my energy and what is fundamentally important and not the side battle? You know, and because they are presenting to us an upside down world. So to put it in the right order, it takes a lot of energy and you need everything to, you know. And so that's an incredibly complicated situation now, because at some point you need to give response to those daily attacks. You know, you need to show the disinformation. You need to prove that those numbers are not the real numbers, etc. But at the same time, you have to find the space to step back a little bit and to see the bigger picture and to strategize on the middle and long term.
Right.
Because,
and also,
that's where the fight should be.
But now, because of these, you know, sort of echo chambers and bubbles that, you know, for me or you to figure out that something isn't true or real may not have any bearing, you know, on the people that fundamentally see the country as a different thing almost entirely than we may.
Yeah. But what does it mean? It means that we need to talk with them.
I know.
We need to talk with them because it's not about good or bad people.
No, I know.
You know, people react to whatever they are going through, and their economical situation in this country determine a lot. You know, I don't want to quote Marx again, but this is where it comes from. You decide, you know, your conscience is different if you have a job or if you don't have a job. And it will determine anything you will do in the coming years. And it includes also sometimes that you don't get the right information, why you lost your job. So when you have populists like Donald Trump coming and say, this is this bad woman that made you lose your job, you know, you don't always have the time to go and find out.
You and know, it satisfies an anger.
Yeah, of course. So we are, it's human, you know, to react to whatever you feel it makes sense to you and it's simple. You know, as you say before, you know, we like simplicity, although our world is complex.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's about how do we get, how we go away from this hate discourse and to try to understand why a worker who sometimes was in a union and a very progressive union suddenly feel the anger to just, or to react to his anger without thinking further and to say, well, this guy who is selling me the car, he's telling me this is the best car ever, you know, and yeah, why wouldn't I take a chance? Because nobody else is even telling me that.
Yeah, and also they've lost belief in all institutions as corruption.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just generations of unexplainable, but yet the explanation is there. Loss of jobs, poverty, loss of pride, loss of ability.
And I think there is one thing, what we call the intelligence, meaning, you know, scholars, universities, schools, and they need to find the way back to these people as well. You know, there was a time when there was big change in society and university were on the forefront. Teachers were on the forefront.
Right.
Scholars were in the forefront.
Yeah.
And we lost that battle. Teachers and I know, you know, I taught at NYU. I taught in many other universities throughout the world. And I see how academia have, you know, create another bubble.
Yeah, insulated themselves.
And, you know, you have research about the most crazy and, sure. really unused type of subject.
Yeah, you never hear anyone say, let's take to the streets and do some further reading.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And there was time where, you know, when you remember the Vietnam War resistance yeah. and all that, you know, your teachers were in the street with you.
Yeah.
And then you would go back in class and discuss what is your society at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, do we take a stand? Do we accept?
Well, they're trying to, you know, there's a concerted effort to take away that dialogue.
Yes, yes. Yes.
And well, now it's a lot easier to take away that dialogue. Yeah. It all takes is one student to go like, that guy's bad.
Yeah.
This is anti-American. It's like that's where the language is going again.
And there is one aspect we forgot, and why is it like this, is there have been a tremendous fragilization of those institutions as well. You know, when universities started to make money
yeah.
in order not to disappear because
right.
state funding were, take away from yeah. them. Now they became businesses. And now as a professor or a teacher, you know, it was about, you know, I should get tenure because then economically I'm safe.
Right.
But it's a way to fragilize also intelligence, to make them scared of losing their job. And it's the same for journalists as well. You know, a lot of part of the intelligentsia had to care for themselves first.
Yeah.
Taking less risk. And, yeah. and then you can intimidate.
Their safety the whole, and their profits.
And their safety and their profits. That's the unfortunately the human attitude in capitalism. You know, it's a very, that's the other thing. It's a historical way of life. You know, capitalism is very specific. It's very clearly determined. The beginning of the industrial revolution that changed the way people communicate, the way, you know, you get jobs, the way you get paid. You know, everything is depending on that. And we cannot, you know, go out of it if we don't understand where it comes from.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a great conversation.
It was.
It's rare, and it's too rare to have that kind of exchange nowadays.
And I appreciate it. And the movie is stunning, and you got to watch it a couple of times.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
That was an amazing conversation. It was different in scope and tone than a lot I had, but also very kind of mind-blowing and powerful to me. So I'm going to play some slightly maybe sad-ish guitar. I don't know. I don't have a plan. Redundant is probably redundant in terms of what I've played in this space before. Boomer lives.